You have your Bibles, turn to Luke 8. Last week, Brad was in Hebrews 3, and he talked about the heading at the top of the bulletin. Order of worship was fighting together unbelief. And so I think today, this week, is a meditation on faith and fighting unbelief, fighting for belief a little bit. And Luke 8 is fuel for the faith that we need. Let's just look at the context before we actually dive in and read it. We'll look at the context of Luke, the context of Luke 8, and then we'll read the passage together. Luke is a doctor, as you know, and we think he was a Gentile, most likely. He's very comfortable in the Gentile world as well as in the Jewish world. He goes back and forth. He understands both worlds, it really seems. We have the phrase, physician, heal thyself in Luke, and so his real attention to health and to miracles, and we'll see that today in that latter half of Luke 8. Luke is also one to record in detail Jesus' interactions with women. And if you look at the beginning of Luke 8, you'll read, and I encourage you maybe to read this later today, or this afternoon, or this week, the beginning of Luke 8, it just lists the women that are traveling with Jesus and the disciples. It also makes mention that they are supporting Christ and the disciples out of their own means. And so this is not just a male-dominated narrative that we're going to study this morning. Jesus is interested in all people. And even this, the miracles we're going to look at today in the end of Luke 8 are two women. Opposite ends of life, a young girl, an older woman. Part of the context of Luke 8 is God's sovereignty. And if you again, have a chance to read Luke 8 today, I would encourage you to do that. You'll see that God is sovereign. Christ is sovereign over nature. And for Christians, this is a very familiar story, the ship in the storm. The disciples and Jesus are crossing the Sea of Galilee, and they're going over from the west coast to the east coast, which is the more Gentile region. And Jesus is about to heal the man with legion, with many demons. And as they cross, there's a storm, and the disciples are terrified, and they cry out to Jesus. You know, and we've seen pictures of archaeological evidence of these types of boats. They're very small, they're very narrow, so they're all crossing together. These boats could be easily swamped, so the storm comes up and they're about to drown. And they cry out to Jesus and say, "Where are you? Don't you care that we're dying?" And Jesus says, he calms the sea. For those, if you're here today and you've never heard this story, Jesus, with a word, calms the sea and the storm is gone, and it's instantly calm. And he says to them in this account in Luke, "Where is your faith?" And so we could take that as a big question over the entirety of this morning. Where is your faith? In Mark, he goes on to say, "Be still, all will be well." And that phrase is also here in Luke. So we see him sovereign over nature. The things that frighten us, just getting in our car and driving down the road, the things that terrify us about life and living, and accidents can happen. Jesus is sovereign over all of that. If we move on a little bit, I mentioned the demoniac of Gadara, as it's often mentioned, or the man with demons. He's demon-possessed. Jesus cast these demons out. There's so many of them that they actually answer, they say their name is Legion. And he casts them into a herd of pigs, and it seems there are almost thousands of these pigs, and they run over the cliff, and they are destroyed. And so Jesus is sovereign over the supernatural, not just the natural. And then we come to this section that we're going to read in verse 40 to the end of the chapter. And Jesus is sovereign over this disease. We have a woman with a flow of blood. And we'll talk about what that means. And then he's sovereign over death. Where Jairus' daughter, or Jairus, she dies. This 12-year-old daughter, his only daughter, she dies. And Jesus is sovereign over death. So we see nature, the supernatural, disease, and death. Most of the things that we're afraid of. And we're going to see verse 50 especially. You might want to circle that. We're going to come back to that a lot. That's the center point of this. He says, "Do not fear, only believe, and she will be well." And I think that's something we could take. That's the positive side of the question to the disciples in the boat. Where is your faith? Do not fear, only believe. So this is the context. And I hope that this story, these miracles that we're going to look at will be fuel for your faith so we can battle unbelief. Last week we talked about from Hebrews 3, not letting the day go by without exhorting each other. Why? Because the sin that surrounds us, the hardness of sin, the sin that surrounds us hardens our heart. And so we must exhort ourselves and each other so our faith will increase. And that's the way we can fight sin. It's not through more effort, it's through our faith. And so today, these stories, I think, will help our faith. So let's look at Luke 8. Let's read this together, starting in verse 40. This is the word of the Lord. Now, when Jesus returned, he's returning from this eastern shore, the Gentile shore, and he's just cast out the demons from this man. He's healed him. He sent him out to witness. So when he returns from that side, he comes back to the Jewish side of Galilee. Now, when Jesus returned, the crowd welcomed him, for they were all waiting for him. They've known about Jesus. He's been healing lepers. He's been casting out demons. He's been raising people from the dead. So there's this big rush of people to see him. Verse 41, and there was a man named Jairus, who was a ruler of the synagogue, and falling at Jesus' feet, he implored him to come to his house, for he had an only daughter, about 12 years of age, and she was dying. As Jesus went, the people pressed around him, and there was a woman who had had a discharge of blood for 12 years. And though she had spent all her living on physicians, she could not be healed by anyone. She came up behind him and touched the fringe of his garment, and immediately her discharge of blood ceased. And Jesus said, "Who was it that touched me?" When all denied it, Peter said, "Master, the crowds surround you and are pressing in on you." But Jesus said, "Someone touched me, for I perceive that power has gone out of me." King James says that virtue has gone out of me. Some kind of saving power, not just an impersonal force. And when the woman saw that she was not hidden, she came trembling and falling down before him, Jesus, declared in the presence of all the people why she had touched him and how she had been immediately healed. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace." While he was still speaking, someone from the ruler's house came and said, "Your daughter is dead. Do not trouble the teacher anymore." And here's the center kind of what we're looking at. We just saw Jesus praise her for her faith. But in verse 50, he says, he hears this comment, "Don't trouble the teacher anymore. It's too late." He says, "Do not fear. Only believe, and she will be well." And when he came to the house, he allowed no one to enter with him except Peter and John and James and the father and mother of the child. And all were weeping and mourning for her. But he said, "Do not weep, for she is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. There was no mistake. But taking her by the hand, he called, saying, "Child, arise." Mark records it as "Talitha kumai." "Child, arise." And her spirit returned. And she got up at once. And he directed that something should be given her to eat. And her parents were amazed, but he charged them to tell no one what had happened. So we're going to flow, just follow the narrative of this morning. I actually don't encourage you to take notes. I just want you to listen and hear the narrative and let it impact you. If notes really help you, then I would encourage you maybe to have verse 50 as a center point and maybe thoughts or notes coming out of that, like spokes on a wheel, or perhaps there's this very public miracle, which is very public with the woman with the flow of blood, and then there's a private miracle where Jesus goes to a house and sends everybody away and raises this girl from the dead. So we're going to look at those in that order. So Jesus is coming back from this Gentile side. He's just healed this man with demons, who is possessed with demons. Notice the difference. The Gentiles don't have the same messianic baggage, you might say, expectation. And so their immediate reaction is fear. They're amazed at what happens. They see this man who's been healed of demons sitting in his right mind. He's got clothes on, finally. If you know this story, that he was in the hills. He was chained. No chains could hold him. And he's now completely different. He's in his right mind talking. He's not screaming and cutting himself. And so they're afraid, and they ask Jesus to politely leave. So they push him away. There's this amazement at Jesus, which is born out of fear, and they actually want him to get away from them. And Jesus comes to the Jewish side, and it's a very opposite reaction, and yet there's some similarities. There's this hubbub about it. There's this rush. Because Jesus has been healing people, he's raised several people from the dead already. He's been in the synagogues. And actually, there's already been a ruckus, if you would say, with the Pharisees. They've tried to throw him over a cliff when he read Isaiah and declared that this prophecy is fulfilled. "I am the Son of God." There was a The Pharisees and the religious leaders were very upset at that. And so there's a lot of people want to get near him and see him and see if this is true. And there's this messianic hope that they have. Maybe he's a political, military leader that they've been hoping for. And yet, in both groups, I think it's important to point out, in both groups, there's people that believe and people that don't believe. In the group on the Gentile side, the man that Jesus just rescued from demons wants to go with him. And Jesus says, no, you stay and you tell people what has happened. And it says that the man went all throughout that country telling people about Jesus. So there's a missionary back to his hometown. Yeah. And so there's people of unbelief and belief over here. And yet there's this amazement and fear. And then there's this kind of rush and popularity and wow, lots going on. And yet there's people we know that don't believe Jesus is the Son of God. There's no saving faith in some of this group. And then there's someone like Jairus who comes forward. So one thing I would say is you have to come to Jesus believing, and it's a personal step you have to make. You can't trust in the group you're in. You can't trust that my group's better than that group, and so I must be okay. That's a very personal, you have to come forward and actually believe these things that are said about Jesus and Jesus' claims. So think about that today. Are you personally believing this? What we sing about and what we read about. These miracles are actually too good to be true in one sense. You have to come and really believe them. So Jairus comes forward. He is a leader of the synagogue. So he probably is in charge of the order of worship. He's an elder of the synagogue. He most likely, and this may not be, there's some debate about this, but most likely he's a Pharisee. So he is probably part of a group that's very, at least, if not opposed, very skeptical to Christ. They've already had a lot of run-ins. And so this is a very humbling moment for him to come away from that, his group, and come and fall at Jesus' feet. It says he falls trembling, and he begs Jesus to come to his home. I mean, Jesus has already been criticized by the Pharisees for going into homes to eating with publicans and sinners and tax collectors. And so now this leader of the synagogue is begging Jesus on his knees in public, very public, begging him to come to his home and heal his daughter. So this probably took some humility, and he probably knew what his friends would say. And it's very easy to stop and say, what are the things that keep us from coming humbly to Christ and asking for help? I mean, there's a lot of them, right? There's a lot of, it could boil down to our pride. And yet many things keep us from even publicly confessing we believe in Jesus, let alone we need help. And it says his only daughter, it seems to be his only daughter, it could be his only child. And it doesn't take a lot of imagination to immediately empathize with that situation. This man's only child, his only daughter, is at the point of death. She probably has been suffering for a while. And we can feel that situation. And so often when our most precious things are threatened, when we feel that death is real, our most precious things are threatened in life, that's when our pride, actually we realize how foolish our pride is. Things that keep us from Christ fall away when we realize none of that matters in the end. So Jairus comes. I want to just compare in our minds, don't turn there, but in Luke 7, right, the previous chapter, a very similar story. A centurion, a Roman centurion, sends to Jesus and says, my servant, who's very important to me, is sick, near to death, please come and heal him. And Jesus goes on his way to heal him. And the centurion actually sends messengers to stop Christ from coming. He says, you don't need to come to my house. I know that if you say something, it will happen. If you declare this person healed, you don't have to be present. You don't have to lay hands on him. This person will be healed. And so, and Jesus is amazed and says, I haven't found faith like this in all of Israel. And so the centurion has an amazing amount of faith. And it's something that we could talk about, meditate on this afternoon. Often we're thinking that if Jesus were just here, or if I could just talk to him, or if I could just see him or touch him, everything would be fine. And yet the centurion knew that the words of God are powerful and can change lives. We have the same thing. We have the exact same thing. We're often wanting Jesus to come into the room and lay hands on our problems. And yet, as the centurion demonstrated in chapter 7, the word of God is so powerful and quick. So the Jairus doesn't quite have that amount of faith, it would seem. He's still acting, thinking of Jesus in human terms. Jesus, you have to come to my house and lay hands on my daughter. He probably thinks of him as the most powerful teacher ever. We don't know exactly. He may think of him as the best doctor ever. And so if you just come and lay your hands on the child, she'll be fine. But you have to hurry and do it before it's too late. So he's still thinking in human terms. But notice Jesus doesn't rebuke him for not having the same amount of faith as someone else. Jesus accepts him, meets him where he's at, and he goes with him. You know, Jesus feels the loss of this only daughter, and he goes with him. So feel this narrative. So we've got, there's an emergency. We all know what can happen in an emergency when there's a 911 call, or if you're watching a soccer game, and I remember watching a soccer game as a 13-year-old, and we heard a crack and a scream, and then we realized someone's leg had broken, and everyone rushed out. And there's this immediate attention and focus when you realize there's a tragedy that's happening in front of you. And so everyone's going, and it says the crowd presses around him. They've just heard that a miracle is going to happen. They want to go see. So they're pressing around Jesus, and then there's this interruption. So feel the pull. Empathize with Jairus for a little while. Yeah, and Peter will do that. We got to get to the house to save the girl. And so then there's this interruption, and this woman with a flow of blood, and Jesus stops. One thing we could just say really quickly is this woman is she's not from a high-ranking family, it would seem. Jairus is a high-ranking leader in the community. He's probably wealthy. So it makes sense that Jesus would help the wealthy and the high-ranking. But Jesus actually interrupts and stops the high-ranking person, says, wait, please. And doesn't say wait, but and he goes and helps this woman who... It seems that she's penniless. It seems she doesn't have a family to help her. And she's of no importance, but Jesus stops. So we could obviously say, every person is important to Christ. Every person here is important to Christ. Jesus is not a respecter of persons or rank or wealth. This woman has a flow of blood. And this we don't know exactly what this is or what caused it. It's been going on for 12 years to the extent where she cannot become pure. Talk about that in a moment. It may be a uterine hemorrhage. It may be the result of childbirth or some medical procedure gone wrong. But this flow of blood, it says that she has spent all her money, so she's poor or penniless. She spent all her money trying to get better. Mark goes further and says, not only is she not better because of what the doctors have done, she's worse. Let me read some Talmudic advice from this time period. So here's some advice for a woman who has this problem. The Talmud would say, take the gum of Alexandria, the weight of a small silver coin, of alum the same, of crocus the same, let them be bruised together. So think mortar and pestle. Bruised together and given in wine to the woman that has an issue of blood. If this does not benefit, take of Persian onions 3 pints, boil them in wine, and give them to her to drink, and say, arise from thy flux. This is probably the kind of things that, if she's going to a Jewish doctor, this is the kind of thing that may have been given to her, and of course it's not helping. There may have been, if Luke is a Gentile and of the Greek kind of approach to medicine, there may be other techniques that were tried, but none of it helped. So she is suffering physically, and then here's the disease. She's suffering physically for 12 years. So we have the two kinds of suffering, human suffering. Just hold this in your mind. We have the types of thing that happen to us, disease or tragedy, that go on and on and on and don't seem to end. For 12 years, this woman has been suffering. And that kind of person is like, where are you, God? Why are you allowing this to happen? When will it end? Please, please end. End my life. On the other side, you have this young girl who's only 12 years old. So 12 years of suffering, a girl who's only 12 years old, everything to live for, and her life's about to be snuffed out. And we say, why? Why would you, God, why would you allow this to happen? She's so young, she has everything to live for. And these are the two kinds of suffering we wrestle with as humans. How can this happen? This, as we'll find, I think, at the end, this is a form of death walking amongst us. Not end of life, but this is a form of death that we have to deal with. You know, it's whether you're, if you're here today and you're a skeptic, you're not a believer, or you're not sure what you are, or you're maybe just full of doubts, you know that all people have to deal with this issue of death and suffering. If you reject Christianity and Christ and his power over this and that there's a plan, if you reject that, you still have the, you're still in the same place. You're still in a boat that might capsize and you don't know what you're going to do. You might drown. You still have disease. You still have young people, 12 years old, who die. And you go, why? What's the point of that? Epicureans, famously, this Greek philosophy is, well, if a death's coming, I might as well enjoy it now. And so they try to just lean into that. Of course, that kind of leaning into it and enjoy everything with abandon actually deadens you. And so death is still winning. The Stoic philosophy, which is probably more popular in the States, perhaps, or in parts of the country, the Stoic philosophy says, well, if death is coming, I'll harden myself. It won't matter. Death can't touch me. I'm going to die. Chop my arm off. Big deal. And yet, that's still deadening us, right? We actually just become dead, so death doesn't touch us, but it's still death. We have to deal with this. So this woman is suffering in disease, and yet there's another piece here that we have to encounter. She is actually suffering under social, spiritual uncleanness. So this flow of blood actually renders her, under the Old Testament ceremonial laws, ceremonially unclean. So what is this? Why is that socially impure? Well, because of this uncleanness, and it says the flow of blood has gone on for 12 years and it has not stopped. And because of that, the flow of blood has to stop for 8 days, and then she can go to the priest and offer a sacrifice and be declared clean. But because the blood never stops, she can never go to the priest and be clean. And because of that, she can't touch anybody. If anyone touches her or thinks she's touched, they become impure. She can't go into the parts of the temple reserved for women. She can't worship with other people. She is an outcast. She's a pariah. She's a leper. And we see in this the effects of the fall. I mean, all of us come into the world and the sin has marked us. We are fallen. We feel the sin upon us. And despite everything we've done, we've gone to doctors, we spent all of our money, we've tried to fix it ourselves, and nothing actually makes it better, makes it worse. Let me just read, just so you feel the power of the weight of this impurity, which is a reminder of our own sin. Let me just read from Leviticus 15. This is great devotional reading. It's laws about bodily discharges, so it's a wonderful thing to meditate on later today. Have your children memorize this. This is reality. I'm skipping some of the parts, but just so you feel like what this woman was under. Verse 25, if a woman has a discharge of blood for many days, not at the time of her menstrual impurity, or if she has a discharge beyond the time of her impurity, this woman here in Luke, all the days of the discharge she shall continue in uncleanness, as in the day of her impurity. She shall be unclean. Every bed on which she lies, all the days of her discharge, shall be to her as the bed of her impurity. And everything on which she sits shall be unclean, as in the uncleanness of her menstrual impurity. And whoever touches these things shall be unclean, and shall wash his clothes, and bathe himself in water, and be unclean until the evening. But if she is cleansed of her discharge, she shall count for herself 7 days, and after that she shall be clean. And on the 8th day, she shall take 2 turtle doves and 2 pigeons and bring them to the priest to the entrance of the tent of meeting. And the priest shall use one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering. And the priest shall make atonement for her before the Lord for her unclean discharge. Wow. This is an amazing weight on her. And she has no hope of becoming pure. And we could think of this in terms of there are people here dealing with disease. There are people here, all of us are dealing with the effects of sin in our lives. It may even be hidden shame or hidden sin that's eating away at us, and we're trying to do it, handle it ourselves. We're trying to take care of it. We're spending money on doctors, and none of it helps. In fact, we get worse. What we need is to come to Jesus in faith and reach out and take a hold of the hem of his garment, the hem of his robe. And notice she does that. The crowd is pressing around him. She probably can barely get to the hem of his garment. And she touches it, and she's instantly and completely healed. So immediately the flow of blood is over. The 12 years of suffering are over. And she's completely healed. You know, notice that when you come to Christ, you don't dim him somehow. There's a sense of if I get too near to Christ or I have to clean myself up in order to approach him. Notice, she would, under the Old Testament laws, make him ritually unclean. He would have to change his clothes and wash and be isolated until evening. But notice the power of Christ, his power, his glory, his majesty over sin and death and impurity is so much that when she comes into contact with him, he does not dim in glory. She is instantly changed. That is a picture of the salvation that we have to stop and personally believe right now. Are you believing that? Is that the kind of power that you believe is in these words in our book or in the gospel message, in the songs we sing to each other? So he says, your faith has made you whole. Notice the connection back to faith. You have to believe this. He calls her daughter. He welcomes her. And this is public. Notice, and then there's this whole bit about who touched me, and Peter says, well, everybody's touching you. Let's go. Let's go. Remember, Jairus' daughter is dying right now. And everyone denies it. The woman denies it. The woman who is just purified, she knows she's been changed, healed, and she denies it. No, it wasn't me. She denies it. Her first act after this is to lie. But why? And why does Christ call her out? Is he just trying to embarrass her? I think there's two reasons. First, she comes before him trembling, and part of the reason is he's just healed her, but the other part is she's probably touched almost everybody in the crowd. The crowd is pressing, they're thronging, they're moving down the road. Probably she's rubbed shoulders with almost everybody, or a lot of people. She's touched the master himself. So under these laws that they're operating in Leviticus, she's made him unclean. She's made all of these people unclean. And that's partly why Jesus draws her out. He says, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace. He instantly transcends these ceremonial laws. And with the power of the Son of God, he declares her clean in front of the community. It has to be public because he's welcoming her back into the community. Not only is she cleansed of the physical ailment, but the ceremonial impurity is now cleansed. And now she's restored to the community of faith and believers. So he publicly restores her, and he doesn't even make her go to the priest. It's not recorded that she has to go do the turtle dove thing with the priest. He actually asked the lepers in Luke 5 to go do that, but here it's done. It's over. And you can see it's a foreshadow of what's happening in the cross. The veil is torn away. Jesus is fulfilling all of this Old Testament. He's created a new covenant. And if we come to him in faith, believing, he will change us. He will transform us. So, Jairus' daughter, as he's speaking, is dead. The word comes. It's too late. Don't tell the master. Don't tell the teacher or anything. I mean, don't bother the teacher anymore. So some of the people, he's just a teacher. It's too late. Death won. And yet Jesus says in verse 50, do not fear, only believe. And she will be well. So again, our faith is put to the test. Jesus can heal a woman from disease and restore her to the community. Can he save us from death? So they move to the house. And he makes this very private. And we'll just go right at the end, he tells the mother and father, tell no one what has happened. This is very strange. He just told the man he rescued from demons to go tell everybody in the Gentile world. And in the Jewish world, he's telling them not to tell everyone. Perhaps one reason is, remember, in Luke, in the beginning of Luke, this is very much part of the Jewish idea of the Messiah. They're waiting for perhaps a political or military figure to come back and save them from the Romans. And Gabriel promises Mary that the Messiah will come and his kingdom will have no end. And so probably there's this idea that if we find the Messiah, we'll put him on the throne, we'll take Jerusalem back, we'll be free of invaders, and his lineage will go on and on and on, and our kingdom will never end. It'll be a glorious, unending kingdom. Of course, that didn't happen. And perhaps Jesus is trying to stave off that idea, that misconception. And he's trying to help people stay focused on believing that God has the power to change and save us from death. So it's private. He sends everybody away, and they go into the house, just the mother and father and just three disciples. And there are professional mourners there, probably family mourning perhaps as well. And professional mourners were often hired, and this is not some kind of make money on other people's grief. It was a way to deal with grief. In the Western culture, we often squelch grief. We kind of hold it in and try to get rid of it that way. And Eastern cultures, there's a sense of releasing it into sound. And you see this in Irish culture, you see it in this culture. So the professional mourners have been brought in. So they've been paid. They often were paid. So she's been dead a while. There's been time to bring the mourners in. There's no accident here. She wasn't sleeping, as we'll see in a moment. But so Jesus hears the mourning, and he says, he almost tells a joke in one sense, and they actually laugh. So she's not dead, she's sleeping. This is not an indication that Jesus is confused or that maybe she was just in a catatonic state, coma. Jesus is taking this thing facing all of us, death, end of life. I'm very conscious as I say this that some of our brothers and sisters are dealing with death very closely right now. He's taking death and he's turning even that on its head and saying, it's actually like sleeping. You young people in the room, adults love to sleep. I know you all don't, but we want to sleep. And sleep is a peaceful thing. It's a gift. And so Jesus is saying, he knows she's physically dead in a human standpoint, but he's saying, she's actually sleeping. And they laugh. And by saying that she's sleeping, he's saying, death is temporary. Watch. And he takes her hand. And her spirit returns to her. And as evidence of that, she's hungry. And he says, give her something to eat. That's the next thing she needs. Jesus touches a corpse. So he's been touched by an impure person on this day. And then he touches a corpse, which would also render him impure. But notice he takes no time. His power and glory and majesty aren't affected by the death of a body. He changes the body. He raises it to life. Notice the ways people reach to Jesus in this story. The woman with the flow of blood reached out to him and just caught the hem of his garment in faith. This girl on the table is dead. She can do nothing. Maybe some of you feel dead this morning. Before Christ, we're dead in our trespasses. We're dead in sin. The wages of sin is death. And Jesus reaches down, takes her hand, and gives her life. And the parents are amazed. We don't know if they actually have saving faith, but they're amazed. They're astonished. But again, we see that same reaction with the crowds that follow Jesus that would later fall away. Let me just say, the amazement is one thing, but faith is something different. Believing this is true. You reaching your hand out to trust in Jesus. And so why... He's sovereign over disease. He's sovereign over death. And so let me just talk to the skeptics for a moment. Maybe there's no skeptics here. Maybe there are folks with doubts. So he raised her from the dead, and the woman with the flow of blood was healed, and yet they're all dead right now. All those people are dead. Everybody's dead that was there, except Jesus. So what's the point, right? The girl was raised up. She went on and lived a life, but who knows? She might have died at 30. So you see, everybody has to deal with this death, this issue of death. And so the reason I say death is actually through this whole chapter is death is a result of the fall. The wages of sin is death. And we deal with death every day. And so by raising her from the dead, Jesus is showing that death is not just temporary. Death has been defeated. And the cross is coming. It's a little sign of that, right? And so right here, death is no problem for the Son of God. He just takes her hand, and instantly she's back alive. Let me read even secular people wrestle with this. Luc Ferry is a teacher at the University of Paris. He's a famous philosopher. And he says that, you know, all religions and philosophies, and anybody who doesn't, if you say you don't have a philosophy, you do have, that's your philosophy. I don't have a philosophy. I just live by whatever. Everyone has a philosophy by which they live, and all religions and philosophy have to deal with death, and all religions and philosophy come down to this question of salvation. How will you achieve salvation? Whatever you call salvation, you may call salvation a great job or getting through the day and not having a meltdown or whatever you call that. And he has a great thought about death. Let me just read this for us. He says, death is not as simple an event as it is ordinarily credited with being. It cannot merely be written off as the end of life, that thing that is in the distance. On the contrary, death has many different faces, and it is this which torments man. Death means everything that is unrepeatable. Death is in the midst of life, that which will not return, that which belongs irreversibly to time past. Notice how we are so bound to time. And Jairus, I'm sure, was wondering, as Jesus was pausing with this woman, why are we waiting? My daughter's dying. She's running out of time. We often pray to God, God, where are you? Why don't you answer me? You know, the time is running out. So, death can mean that which we have no hope of recovering. It can mean childhood holidays with friends, the divorce of parents, or the houses or schools or jobs or dreams we have to leave, or a thousand other examples. So, Jesus, by raising this child, shows that he is powerful, sovereign over death and over all the effects of death that we deal with every day. And he says to her, this is why in verse 50, do not fear. Do not fear the end of life. Do not fear the diseases that come or nature that may trip you up or the supernatural. Only believe. It's not a belief in ourselves or in the power of positive thinking. It's a belief that Jesus Christ walked the earth. He was the Son of God. And that when people reached out to him in faith, they were instantly fully changed. And he restored them. That he reached out to people that were dead and lifted them up from the grave. And in the end, we sang about this, we will have a home one day. And imagine a home without disease or death, or really time. Imagine us sitting down to a feast together, and the food never gets cold or runs out. There's room for everybody. The kids don't throw food, and you don't need to keep getting up. People without kids or singles, the kids aren't bothering you or throwing things in your face or sneezing in your drink. None of that's happening. And you don't have to hurry. You don't have to get back home and let the dog out. There's no fear of fire or thieves while you're away. You can sit and rest in the presence of Christ with no rush. And this all seems too good to be true. And that's why we have to fight together and exhort one another daily to believe these things. Let's bow our heads, and I'll give you a moment to, after I close in prayer, I'll give you a moment to meditate on these things. And perhaps you're like the disciples in the boat, the storm is around you, feel like you're going to drown, and Jesus is not answering, or you're Jairus, and you're wondering, why is God delaying? Or you're the woman with the flow of blood, and it's been 12 long years, and there's no help, you're only worse. Jesus says, where is your faith? Do not fear, just believe. Believe in Jesus.